Dr. Patrick Vivier, welcome.
Thank you very much. It's good to be here.
You and a group of researchers recently published a study that found that a law aimed at preventing childhood lead poisoning works when it's followed. And I want to ask you to walk us through that study and how you did it and about your results. But first, I thought it would be important to just take a moment to walk our listeners through the hazards. How do kids end up with lead poisoning, and what are the effects of that?
Sure. The overriding way that children are exposed to lead now is through homes and lead paint. Historically, there have been a number of ways that children could be exposed, or anybody could be exposed. I mean, adults can be exposed to lead poisoning as well. We used to have lead in our gasoline. We used to have lead in our paint, where there have been over time laws to help control that. Really, the biggest exposure we think at this point is that your house doesn't go away. If it was painted before 1978, that paint for most of us is still in there someplace. And when it does not have to even be gross cracking, but anywhere that lead can come out, you have an issue. Also, if over time that has been an issue in the home, that lead can then be in the soil outside. It can be in the dust of the house, and children can get exposed.
By ingesting
exactly.
Or inhaling?
For us in the U.S., it's really about ingesting. People think of that iconically as a child chewing on a windowsill, and it really doesn't, or eating lead paint chips, big chips, which can happen, but it can be much, much more subtle than that. It can really just be that the dust in the house has some not even visible lead paint in it, and that kids mouth things. Kids put their toys in their mouth, their hands in their mouth, and even at very low levels of that exposure, it picks off IQ points that don't come back. And so even if you take care of the lead problem once you have diagnosed it in the child, that damage can be there.
Wow. And that happens so quickly, even, you know, before the end of the first or second year of life?
Yes. So the main time that you will see the levels peaking generally in sometime between 9 months and 2 years. So the usual time that we as pediatricians check lead levels is usually around the first year of life or a little bit sooner in high-risk kids. And then it's by the state recommendation and real law should be checking it annually unless there's some certain characteristics that lower the risk a great deal. So it's that early life exposure, and there's sort of two reasons for that. That's when your brain is really developing. So it's the unhappy connection of the time when your brain is so sensitive to insults like lead and other insults. And also at the time when little babies love to put things in their mouth. And so whether, again, that's their toys or their hands or their whatever, mouthing behavior is pretty normal in that age group. And so it's your biggest chance to get exposed to the lead at the same time that your brain is so sensitive to it.
We have this law on the books that was passed in 2005 that requires some landlords have landowners, if they have a certain number of units in a rental property, and there are some other permutations, but it requires some of them to clean up lead hazards. And you and a group of researchers from a number of institutions set out to find out whether that law is working. And to do that, you combined a number of different data sources, records, databases. I mean, it's kind of mind-boggling to me. 50,000 different housing records, the records of children's blood tests, matching up where the kids lived at the time they got the blood test to the property. I mean, is there any way you could sort of boil it down and walk us through this very, very massive and complex effort?
As you mentioned, it is a team. Michelle Rogers, a data analyst, both at Hasbro Children's Hospital and at the School of Public Health, is the lead author, and I'm the senior author. But we worked with the Rhode Island Department of Health, and particularly with Providence Plan. One of the things we're really fortunate in Rhode Island, so we face some challenges in that we have old housing stock. So if we're talking about lead poisoning specifically, we have more than our fair share of lead because we have more than our fair share of old houses in the United States. So when we look across the country, we do have a particular risk here because of our housing stock. But we also have some strengths, and that is a real sense of cooperation, connection, and a real public health focus. So the Department of Health, in their regulations in terms of lead screening, not only requires lead screening of children, which I think is very indicated given our state and the burden we have with old housing, but requires that those tests be done at a lab that is certified and reports all results to the Department of Health. So the Department of Health has every lead test done in Rhode Island for children back into the 1990s. Mm-hmm. But in this, we specifically wanted to try to get some sense of this law. And our houses getting the certificates they're supposed to get, or even those who are not required, are those getting them? So that sort of data comes from a couple of different places, from those who are involved, depending on which type of lead certificate.
So you looked at, you know, you have these blood test records.
Yes.
And then you looked at actual property records, which ones got a certificate saying they cleaned up the lead, which ones didn't, and then you tried to match them?
Exactly.
And so you found that kids who lived in properties that indeed had a certificate on file showing that they'd cleaned up lead hazards, they had lower levels of lead in the blood?
Yeah, after the certificate. It's probably one of the more complex parts of the study, though, in that, again, this is not a randomized controlled trial to look at the effect of these certificates. So you have to look at who got the certificates, how many kids were tested before or after. But that part of the result was encouraging, that if you looked at the places specifically that got a certificate and looked at the screening tests done for children in that home before that certificate and those done after, that blood lead level seemed to come down.
You also found that compliance with the law is pretty low.
Yeah, there were two major limitations when we look at the impact of the law. And again, these are complex issues. When you're dealing with a health threat like this, how you address them. But the law is a great thing, but there are two issues in the law. What percentage of homes are even covered by it? Mm. And then those who are covered by it, do they get the certificate? And I think in both cases, our study really pointed out the limitations.
So a lot of properties are exempt.
Yes.
Of the properties that are covered, about what?
Most.
One in five, most are not
are
complying
not.
With the
exactly.
law.
Exactly. That really, as we try to move away from waiting for a child to get poisoned to kind of going out there and addressing those issues, you know, if our goal is to protect every child and really do primary prevention where they never get exposed, if the law doesn't really apply to most properties and then those properties that it applies to, it doesn't happen, the certificate doesn't happen, obviously that's a significant limitation to what the impact of that law can mm-hmm. be.
You know, clearly you would like to see the laws impact broadened. You would like to see, obviously, more property owners complying with it and more properties covered by the law. What are the other implications, or what else do you hope comes out of your work?
Yeah, I think you've summed it up nicely, that if the intention of the law is to really protect children in a primary prevention way, what our finding is saying that there are these two major limitations to this, that one, in looking at the law to be thinking about, it doesn't cover most properties. And in those properties, as you find in the study, those children in those properties do seem to be at less risk than the properties that aren't exempt, but they're still at risk. And since there are so many of those properties, if your goal really is to make our state the healthiest place in the world for kids, the law is not affecting most houses. And it's also not affecting because it isn't enforced.
Dr. Patrick Vivier, thank you for joining us. Patrick Vivier is a pediatrician at Hasbro Children's Hospital and a professor in the School of Public Health at Brown University.
Healthcare reporting on Rhode Island Public Radio is funded in part by a grant from the Rhode Island Foundation, Rhode Island's only community foundation.